From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
Is a five-decade-old Supreme Court decision to blame for the era of misinformation? A legal scholar argues it may be, and his sweeping Law Review article was just cited 16 times in a dissent by a U.S. Supreme Court justice, making the argument that the seminal First Amendment case that many saw as adding strong protections to a free press should be revisited. Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White. Ted Nesi is off this week. Joining me in studio to talk about his Law Review article and the implications of that case is Roger Williams University School of Law professor David Logan. Good to see you. Welcome into the onto the program. I feel like I should make a brief disclosure just out of total transparency. I'm also a student at the law school, but I've never had you as a professor. And depending how this interview goes, maybe I shouldn't. I don't know. We'll see. So first of all, let's just set the table. The case I referred to at the top of the show here is New York Times v. Sullivan. So people at home understand. What is this case and why is it important?
This case sets up very high barriers to people who are suing to protect their reputation. And as a practical matter, in the data over the 50-some years since then, virtually every person who's categorized as a public figure or public official loses their libel suits because of the protection set up by New York Times in the subsequent cases. So it has dramatically tipped the playing field between reputation and First Amendment protections.
New York Times v. Sullivan, 1964, right? This was not an article by the New York Times. This was an ad, and it was at a time of segregation. And the ad that appeared in the New York Times was, the thrust of it was true, right? It was calling out bad things that were happening in the South. Didn't even name Sullivan, I believe, but right. He made this argument that it, you know, hurt his reputation and that the New York Times should have worked harder. There were some mistakes in the advertisement. Again, I want to stress that it wasn't an article. And, you know, you had a jury down in Alabama that huge award at the time, relatively speaking, against New York Times, and it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. In the context of segregation of 1964, was it the right decision at the time?
Absolutely. This was just one of a number of pending lawsuits against the New York Times and other major media outlets that were trying to hold a light on what was going on in Alabama, Mississippi in particular. And they published this advertorial with zero fact-checking because of the credibility of the people who were submitting the ad. And as a result, under Alabama law and the law of most states at the time, if there were factual misstatements in that ad that could be linked to L.B. Sullivan, the police commissioner, they could raise a jury question and get to a jury. And it was a horrible situation. The judge was an outright segregationist. He may have been actually involved in keying up the lawyers to bring this lawsuit. The jury was all white. They deliberated for just a matter of minutes and came back with the largest award in Alabama history. And there were many, many similar lawsuits in the pipeline. Supreme Court had to do something. And I don't think there's anybody in the academy or certainly in your field that thinks the Supreme Court should have turned its head and let libel law just proceed as it did before because of its power to intimidate a vigorous press.
Fast forward 54 years, here we are now talking about it. Should the New York Times v. Sullivan be overturned?
No.
Okay, so what do you, when you, reading your Law Review article, you provide a host of possible remedies from what you call low-hanging fruit, defining who is a public official. That includes anybody who's employed by the government, I suppose, police officers on up. So maybe just let's look at the higher tiered elected officials or something like that. But really, what we're talking about here is the actual malice standard. So this is the intent that a news organization or somebody might have in defaming someone. They did it purposefully. They intended to do it. And you think that should be reexamined and maybe that intent standard should be lowered, right?
That's one of a number of pieces to the puzzle.
Isn't that overturning it?
No.
It's not?
No.
Changing the intent out of a holding?
Well, first of all, there were at least four different ways in which New York Times v. Sullivan changed the law of libel in the states. And, I could spend another 10 hours
right.
on the law.
I wish our show were longer.
But that's certainly an important part of this, which is it's almost impossible to prove Certainly reputable media, mainstream media, actually lied before they when they published something. That's almost impossible to prove. On the other hand, in many states, a person who's a private figure can win by proving merely negligence. They're sloppy. They didn't follow up. And so those two standards, negligence and actual malice, there's some space between them. And other states have considered a spot on the continuum sort of between those two spots that would give some plaintiffs a bigger chance, a better chance of getting to a jury and having a jury verdict upheld than the actual malice standard, which basically is zero chance. There were three trials in the entire United States on libel law in 2017. Three. Think of how many malpractice trials there were, slip and fall trials there were, yet there's billions of information going out.
All right, but so there are a lot of ills and misinformation we talked about, and I know you're a law school professor, but why is litigation the answer?
I do not claim that revisiting New York Times is a silver bullet, and I certainly don't support overturning it in toto. But I do think, and we have a recent Rhode Island case that you and I were just talking about
that
underscores part of the problem. A cop was alleged to be involved in a retribution scheme of ticketing and
the Cranston ticketing scandal. A lot of our viewers are familiar with that story. Yeah,
and so the reporter got a tip about a certain cop who was allegedly involved in this, mm-hmm. and rushed to publish at the 6 o'clock news before he spoke to the person who he was going to be criticizing mm-hmm. or defaming. And following up with a key possible witness that would have explained that. And led him, eventually, hours later, to withdraw the story when he got the actual facts of the case.
And make a correction.
Yeah. He made a correction. That's terrific. Yeah. In the meantime, on the local news, a local cop is basically alleged to be a crook. And part of the problem of the New York Times line of cases is, as you've identified, if you are anywhere in the structure of government, you are given this enormous burden to carry to win a libel suit. Why should a cop on the beat?
Oh, yeah, but they are also given indemnification protections, all of that. Talking about in an era officers that are under scrutiny, right? I mean, so...
Well, being under scrutiny and lying is not the same thing, and misstatements that are not verified and checked. And under a regime, unlike New York Times, that Rhode Island cop would have had a chance to basically uphold his reputation. And he failed because the Rhode Island Supreme Court, following this line of cases, said he's a public official. The reporter didn't consciously lie. He just did a crappy job of investigating.
That one element, the large thrust of the story that Jim Terracani did was correct and true. He had that one element that was wrong and should have made that phone call, no doubt. But what we're talking about here isn't necessarily the work of news organizations. You make the great point in your Law Review article that it is the, I think you used the word cesspool of social media and the misinformation that comes out of there. When I asked you the question, why is litigation the answer? Our own Congressman David Cicilline is looking at reexamining the Communications Decency Act, which right. leaves the internet unregulated. You're sitting in a studio right now. We are regulated by the FCC. There's a different standard when it comes to Facebook, when it comes to Twitter. And isn't that where we're talking about the real problem, the issue that you're trying to highlight here?
There is no doubt about it that the CDA needs to be amended to put more pressure on social media platforms to monitor what's published. Do I think that that's anything the courts can do about it? Do I think that's anything that litigators can do about it? No, that's Congress, and Congress right. has enough trouble passing legislation to fill potholes, let alone actually changing this major force in our social life and our economy. So if the CDA gets amended in a positive way that makes it they have more incentives to pay attention to what's posted on their platforms, I'll cheer. But the Supreme Court and the subsequent cases made part of this problem by extending New York Times to all sorts of situations that really don't implicate true democracy values. The reputation of a cop, the reputation of a teacher, the reputation of a rape victim mm-hmm. who tried to sue Bill Cosby was dismissed because she was a public figure. These definitions sweep in millions of Americans who shouldn't have to give up their right to a reputation because the media is trying to hit a 6 o'clock deadline.
Did you consider at all when you were doing all of your research on this about the practical impact of moving away from New York Times v. Sullivan and what it could mean to newsrooms across the country? Because look, the New York Times is going to be fine. They have deep pockets. They can weather very pricey defamation lawsuits. And frankly, they, like most newsrooms, have high standards. The reporters go to journalism school and all of that, right? Well,
sometimes law school.
And sometimes law school. but what I think I worry about a little bit is what the impact, when you're trying to fix the problem we just discussed over here, is, you know, there may be a chilling effect mm-hmm. on enterprise and investigative reporting because the corporations that own a lot of these newsrooms now will just don't want to have the risk mm-hmm. of that kind of reporting. Do you think that could be a fallout of maybe changing even the standard of New York Times?
I think it could be a fallout, but something that slows the pressure of the 24-hour news cycle to make it, let's say, like it used to be, like a 36 or 48 or 1 week news cycle. So there actually is physically time for the reporter to verify rather than publish and then verify.
I would love to have a longer deadline, so I won't argue a day on that. That would be fantastic.
But I do think that one of the consequences of this is going to be more care in the vetting of stories. And it may be the news organizations that already, by and large, are careful are going to slow down and be even more careful and maybe occasionally not publish stories that were accurate because they couldn't prove it. And that's a loss to democracy. Don't get me wrong.
Okay.
But that's not a loss to democracy when it's a school teacher, when it's a cop, when it's the head of a recreation center. People who are swept into this New York Times environment who are very far away from the leaders and the high government officials that was the focus of New York Times.
I think there are some people watching right now who might disagree with you that less scrutiny on policing, say, in the era that we're in right now, would be a positive outcome of all of that. But I have to ask you this because, you know, just the reason you're here is you were cited by Justice Neil Gorsuch. Did I have that right? 16 times?
Who's counting?
Yeah. I mean, I just on a sort of geeky way. What was that like when you learned that your law review article was cited? That doesn't happen every day. Have you ever been cited in a Supreme Court?
I was cited once before in the 80s by Justice Scalia. So I keep getting cited by conservative justices. I don't know what's wrong with me. That's not the way I vote.
People are going to wonder that. So Neil Gorsuch, appointed by President Donald Trump, and viewers might think, this guy must be conservative. Address that.
Well, just because people agree on a complicated issue, don't tar me with the Donald Trump brush. That's been already attempted several times.
I'm sure.
Sometimes Donald Trump got things right. Mm-hmm. I know people hate hearing that. Most of the time he got it wrong, and I will be glad to have beers with you and discuss the long litany. But on this question, what Neil Gorsuch was saying was, shouldn't we have a conversation? It was a remarkably modest foray into this field. He did not adopt any of the particular remedies that I proposed. He couldn't because he was just one justice.
Yeah.
But he is saying the world has changed. We have a living constitution. Shouldn't we take another look at this body of law that was created in a fundamentally different political and a fundamentally different media environment? That's all he's saying. That's all I'm saying. I didn't say reverse New York Times. The title did not say that. Mm-hmm. Don't put that word in my mouth. Mm-hmm. I said revisit, and I mean the line of cases, the whole body of law that grew out of New York Times v. Sullivan, much of which went too far.
I never like to predict what a court is going to do when I'm covering a trial or what a jury is going to do, so I'm going to ask you to do it. What do you think the likelihood is that this might actually happen? It does seem it started with Justice Thomas, right? He sort of broached there, though. He had a different take than Justice Gorsuch did. And now he's there, and then we have a pretty conservative court. What do you think?
Well, I don't think this breaks down on conservative-liberal lines necessarily, mm-hmm. because one of the things I dug up was a book review by Elena Kagan that she wrote when she was on the faculty at Harvard, which raised this exact question that I raised, which is maybe New York Times was right, but maybe what went beyond it was a problem. And so if I'm looking at my crystal ball, This was one justice on the last day of the term writing an opinion that has no precedential weight whatsoever. Clarence Thomas wrote a very different opinion with the same basic goal, except he says, I want to get rid of this line of cases. So he's far more extreme on this Neil Gorsuch. Neil Gorsuch is asking for a colloquy. And as this court seems to be less wedded to stare decisis, following the weight of history,
which we should tell our viewers is precedent from the
following
court.
Precedent, I would not be surprised. It takes four votes to hear a case that the right case coming up, and I know some that are coming up through the pipeline that raise the issue of the extent of the sweep of New York Times v. Solomon, that will have two votes, almost certainly Thomas and Gorsuch. Elena Kagan is interested in this question. At least she was back when she was digging in the fields And Sam Alito seems very willing to break the furniture and revisit things. So there might well be four votes. And I can tell you sort of the interest that this opinion has received, considering it's one justice opinion, is really signaling, first of all, the media is worried about this. But second of all, because it really is an invitation. He's inviting a conversation, and that might pull in some justice to say, don't be afraid to go back and look. Maybe we'll just revisit and agree in all particulars. But the world has changed. Should the law not ever change to reflect the current reality?
All right, we have to go to a break, but that's why you're here, and I congratulate you on the Law Review article, because it is a very important discussion to have. It's a thick one, but it's an important one, and with your permission, I'd like to link to the Law Review article on our Newsmakers page if you want to see it on WPRI.com. Professor David Logan, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
It's been my pleasure.
All right, well, when we come back, it was an amazing mystery out of southeastern Massachusetts. Author Maureen Boyle will join us on set. You're going to hear this story. Stay with us. You're watching Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White. Ted Nesi is off this week. I'm joined by investigative reporter Maureen Boyle, and she has a new book out called The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams in the Hunt for His Killer. Maureen, congratulations on the book. Welcome to the program. And many of our viewers may remember this case, which it really burst back on the public scene about 5 years ago when the FBI made a renewed push to find the killer of a police chief in a small Pennsylvania town. Who was Donald Eugene Webb?
Donald Eugene Webb was a low-level thief, wannabe mobster, with some ties to Rhode Island. He was a member of the so-called Fall River Gang, very unique title there. Mm-hmm. They did a lot of crimes throughout the East Coast. Not that many in the greater Fall River area, because they didn't do their crimes where they slept, so
right.
to speak. They did a lot of jobs in Pennsylvania, in New York, in Connecticut, Virginia, I believe even also in Ohio, the mid-Atlantic states. He did a lot of time in Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts.
A lot of time meaning?
A lot of time. Prison time. Prison time. He married a woman from New Bedford. Her son eventually became a New Bedford cop. And that is when Donald Eugene Webb was with his group in Pennsylvania. And at one point, they believe he was alone, and he was stopped by a police chief in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. It's a very small community in western Pennsylvania. It is, think Mayberry, USA. That is Saxonburg. The police chief, of course, was one of two.
Young guy.
He was in his early 30s. He was one of two full-time police officers on the department. That is how small this town was. He pulls him over in an Agway parking lot.
And this is Chief Adams on the screen right now.
Chief Greg Adams. He had two small children at the time. He pulls Donald Webb off into the parking lot. A type of a confrontation happens, and the chief winds up being shot during this confrontation. During that period of time, Donald Webb was also wanted in upstate New York for jumping bail.
Well, we're going to fast forward now to 2016, 2017. Again, the FBI does a renewed push.
Donald Eugene Webb was on the FBI's most wanted list for a long time. They knew who killed Chief Adams. They just couldn't find him, and they suspected he was back in the southeastern or the south coast of Massachusetts. Okay, so renewed push. His body was ultimately exhumed from a shallow grave behind his home in North Dartmouth. How did he hide out for so long without being discovered? And no one dimed him out.
No, they didn't. It's believed that he was staying with his wife for most of that period of time. And if anyone would come to the house, he would hide in the basement in a sort of
a secret
shower,
room.
It was more of a shower-like room. It wasn't a room where you would be able to move around freely.
Short-term stay.
Yes,
someone's
yes.
at the front door, you go to the basement, to the secret space. And
you wait until they leave.
Right.
But he was coming, from what I understand, he was coming and going from her home throughout all of those years.
Hiding in plain sight?
Very much so.
Well, then if he was wanted, they knew who it was, and he's out and about, why didn't anybody make a phone call and say, hey, I just saw Donald Eugene Webb at the market?
And that is the question. Those that knew he was wanted weren't saying, and those who may have seen him in the area and didn't know he was wanted, this was an era before social media.
Before the internet.
Yes, way before. And there was a time when there was no internet.
So if this wasn't front page news and the newspaper that hit everybody's driveway.
No one knew.
That's nuts.
It is.
I got to tell you, that's nuts.
And it wasn't in the local papers, and that was even crazier. Mm. I went through all of the microfiche of the local newspapers, and if anyone who has not done that type of research, it'll make you dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very little about the case. There was one article in the Fall River Herald News a few months after the killing that said that he was wanted.
I knocked on the door. I did some reporting on this back, I interviewed the FBI agent for that and when they were doing the push and then when they were exhuming the body, I was there with my photographer, John Villela. For the original story, before they got to the point where they were doing the digging in the backyard, I knocked on the door of Webb's widow's home and left my card. She called me back and said, quote, I don't know anything. I can't help you out. And then she hung up. That, of course, was not true.
No, that was not true at all. She was very well aware of where he was and where he had been throughout that entire period of time.
My recollection was she cooperated with law enforcement to help lead them to the body, which suggests that she was indemnified, that she was granted some sort of immunity. Is that a good assumption?
That is exactly what happened. The chief's family decided to file a civil suit against her. And that, of course, as we all know, a civil suit involves money. And that apparently caught her attention.
Mm-hmm.
And a deal was reached where the family would agree to drop the civil suit. And the Massachusetts district attorney and the district attorney's office in Butler County in Pennsylvania, both of them agreed not to press any charges against her. However, the FBI never, ever signed off on the issue of federal charges. So that is still out there, but it does not appear that they're going to charge her federally.
All right, we have about 2 minutes left here, Maureen, and I do want to get down to Pennsylvania and into Saxonburg. You painted a quick picture, Mayberry. You went down there for your reporting.
Yes.
You went down there again after the book came out, and I'm just wondering what kind of reaction you've gotten from the folks in Saxonburg about this. This is such a small town. I know we're talking four decades ago almost, but they have to still remember.
Yes. Everyone remembers. It is part of the fabric of the community. Because it's such a small town, everyone was tied to the chief. Everyone was tied to this murder. Either they saw him on that fateful day, they were there when he was found, they were at the funeral, they went to church with him, or they're parents were a part of the search. I mean, it touched every single person in that community to this day. And when they speak of Greg Adams, they speak his name in very reverent terms. Mm. They have never, ever forgotten him. And when I went there this last time, once the book came out, the reception that we received from the people in Saxonburg was really heartwarming. They're very, very thankful and grateful that no one has forgotten what happened in their community and what happened to Greg Adams. While people up here seem to have forgotten about Donald Webb, that he was wanted for killing a police chief, that is still a living memory in that community.
All right, well, we got to go. If the weather ever gets better and you need a beach read, this is it. Maureen Boyles, the ghost. Maureen, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on Newsmakers.